Okay. So here's another morning indoctrination in the re-education camp of Charnock Grove. Well, it's good indoctrination. Because it's a very wide indoctrination in the sense that people feel a wonderful sense of freedom if they learn the Dhamma. It's one of the things I was saying last night when you asked me what's the ninth and the tenth factor of the Eightfold Path, as it were. I mean, what follows after the eight path factors, and then what happens next? And then, of course, you get the freedom and the knowledge of freedom. But you know, what actually is freedom? Sometimes that people think they live in a free world, and I think even in the United States, they say the land of the free. Whether they say there's more people in jail in the United States than in the rest of the world combined. But it gives an idea of the complexity of the word freedom and what actually it means to be free. And of course, that sometimes from the outside, people look at monks and nuns and say, why do you do that to yourselves? Why do you live in tiny little caves? And why have you got all these rules? You can't do this and you can't do that. You know, why can't you just hang loose? Why can't you just, what they used to say when I was a young person in the 60s, why don't you let it all hang out? Sometimes I do. And the idea of, do you really need discipline to be free? And it's the two different types of freedom. Because there are some types of freedom, doing what you want, going where you want, just looking at what you like, listening to whatever you like. Is that really freedom? And it's one of the things we always challenge when you're meditating. You're sitting here, perfectly still. It is like you are in a straitjacket, that you're in a cell. But why is it we feel so free? It was weird that when I started keeping precepts, keeping the rules, and I felt more free than ever before. Weird. And the answer is, it was a wonderful little anecdote of those two monks in Thailand many years ago. And those two monks were at a person's house waiting for the morning meal. And you know, they were just sitting there while they were just making the final preparations. And like in many people's houses, there was an aquarium, a fish tank. And of which one of the monks said, that's really not Buddhist. So actually to keep fish in a tank just for your own personal amusement. What do the fish think about that? What bad karma did they do to be put in a prison in somebody's house where they have to look at you all the time? And imagine if you put that fish tank just opposite the TV and always having cat programs or torture and terrorize those poor fish. But and the other one was very, had all this wise anecdote. Yes, fish in a tank. They cannot go to do what they would like to do. They cannot swim all over the lakes. They cannot go here, they cannot go there, but there's many advantages and other types of freedoms. If you live in a water tank as a fish. And the first of those advantages is you never ever see a person dropping a fishing line into a tank full of fish with a hook on the end. You're not allowed to fish in somebody else's aquarium. So those fish are very fortunate. They don't have to worry about being fished out of their tank. And sometimes that you'd wonder, I don't know what you ate today, but you ate your breakfast, you put it on a plate or in a bowl, and you were quite safe. Imagine what it was like to be a fish in the rivers. You're having your breakfast, and this looks a very delicious piece, and you chomp on it, and there's a bit of a sting on the top of the palate, and yank! And then you leave the dining hall forever. And the anchor can't find you, I can't find you. Where are you? You'll be hooked and taken away. So that's the first thing. You're safe from the danger of fishermen. And number two is you never put sort of cannibal fish in the same tank with other fish. So, sometimes if you hear everybody is nice and kind, you don't have to worry about anybody, they're not going to fight after the last piece of toast. It's just going to be safe for you. But in the nature, the big fish, they prey on the small fish. And sometimes they eat them. So you don't have to worry about that. It's fish in a tank. Are free from bully fish and predator fish and cannibal fish. So they can swim around happy as can be. And of course, you've already experienced so far that sometimes it's cold in here, sometimes it's hot in here. And in the fish tank, it's always exactly the right temperature. Because the fish tank is always climate controlled. Much better than here. And also in the fish tank, what else is there? Oh yeah, it never runs out of water. Every now and again you see pictures of droughts, or when there's a tsunami, or there's floods. And then when the floods come, all sorts of other big animals can float everywhere. I remember hearing in Bangkok, when it floods, sometimes the crocodiles, they actually escape from the crocodile farms and go on a little holiday for a few days, touring around the streets of Bangkok where they're not supposed to be, swimming here, swimming there, until they get caught and put back in their crocodile farm. But in a tank, it's always safe. There's always water there, always the right temperature, and always food. Now, just like this place, it's always nice food every morning, every afternoon. And those fish, they get some nice... They don't even need to queue up for it. Not like you. It's like home delivery. It's like, it comes to the top of their tank, once, twice, three times a day. Imagine it's like having breakfast in bed. I don't know if it's anyone's birthday, but on birthday, should we actually institute that on birthdays, having breakfast in bed? Maybe we can't go there. We do that on your death day, though, okay. So, Enlightenment Day. Actually, in Enlightenment Day, you don't need breakfast in bed because you've got no more defilements. So you don't need breakfast in bed when you're enlightened. So we can all have breakfast in bed when you get enlightened so that you can actually... But anyway, and lastly, what else do they... Oh yeah, they have free healthcare in a water tank, in a aquarium. Because people care for those fish. So if they feel a bit sick or they look a bit sick, they bring the fish doctor up to look after them. So, then the question is, which type of fish would you like to be? A fish in a tank? Safe, secure, peaceful, well-fed, nice and warm, not too sort of cold, lots of water always around, you can finish totally safe. Would you like to be a fish like that? Or would you like to be a fish like out in the wild, in the wilderness, being eaten by mosquitoes, by being unsafe, having to work really hard with bosses which don't appreciate you, and just always getting sick and always getting into trouble and always just worrying about the economy and always wondering about the politics and wondering about climate change and wondering about how you're going to make it and survive. What type of fish would you like to be? It's amazing how many fish want to actually be out there in the wild. What do you want to do that for? Because we're bored with peace. We're afraid of comfort. We like to stimulate ourselves and get into trouble. And I can never figure that out. Why is it? If life isn't dangerous naturally, why do people like to go on these bungee jumps? Some of those ropes actually break. You don't know what you're doing. Hurtling down so fast. Why do they want to go these death drops? You know, I haven't seen it. Oh, actually, I've only seen it on a picture. No, no, photograph. Never actually been there. You stand in this machine or something, and then bang, you go straight down. It must really scare the life out of you. What do people do that for? More than that. Sorry? Let what go? I don't know. I know what I would let go. And I'd have to go to the toilet afterwards and clean myself up. And worse, they actually pay for that. You know, that's the sort of thing I would expect someone to do to me, to torture me, to try and get me to confess to something which I never did. But anyway, the simile of a fish in a tank is a simile of people who keep a simple life, restrained by precepts, and you find you're happier. It's weird. You are actually happier. Because that's one of the strange things which I discovered, even as a lay Buddhist, that when I started restraining my senses, it was by keeping precepts. You know, not drinking alcohol. Never got into drugs. Never, not stealing. Being a good person. It made me happy. Weird. One of the things was that it was like I decided to, you know, there was nothing wrong with drinking alcohol when I was a kid, you know, as a young man. Everyone else was doing it, but I decided to say, no, I'm not going to do that. And I felt this wonderful sense that I wasn't concerned what other people thought of me. I had made a decision, and I was going to keep it. And I felt so much more inner strength that you weren't being controlled by others. Ah, come and have a drink. Ah, come and do this. Ah, come and come out here. Oh, come and do this. And sometimes you were so concerned what other people thought of you that you were just given and just do it to please others. But when you started to have some restraint, I would follow what you did if I think it was a good idea myself, but otherwise I'm not going to do it. And the strange thing was, at the end of my university days, I asked my friends, I said, I was a Buddhist, and I never drank alcohol. What did you think of that? And then, when we got feedback, because I laughed, I was trying to find out what they really thought of me. And what they said, the thing they respected, that even though, I made that decision, I was not going to drink alcohol, but nevertheless, I never told other people what to do. I was never an evangelist, never telling people this is what you must do. And so what happened was they respected me even more. So when you think about what other people think of you, if you make a decision, a choice, this is what you want to do, this is what you think is the right way of life for you at this time of your life, this time of your many lives through samsara, and you made that decision, you don't criticize others, this is just what you wanted to do. Then you get a huge amount of inner strength and respect. You are a fish, you're in the tank, and you're happy being there. And other people can say all sorts of things, I don't care what you think of me, this is where I feel comfortable. That degree of strength is one of the reasons why you start to have some happiness in your life. Not just following what other people do. And when it comes to following what other people do, there was a monk years ago, his father was a farmer in Mandichong. His name was Visarada. Many people might remember him a long time ago. And he would tell me that his father had a big farm, and one day he went out just to check up on the sheep. And he said he doesn't know to this day how this began, but he knew if he hadn't have interfered, it would probably still be going on today. Well, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but what had happened was that there was a thicket of bushes in one of the fields, and the sheep, somehow or other, had formed a circle around this thicket of bushes. And so from one side, you couldn't see to the other side, and the sheep were just walking in a circle, going round and round and round, following the sheep in front of them. In other words, they had formed a circle which would have been going on and on and on and on for days, because that's the nature of sheep, to follow one another. And so, which is fine if it's in a straight line somewhere, but when it's going round in a circle and they can't see the other side, that would go on forever. And that sort of kind of reminded me of samsara. Everybody following other people, round and round and round we go. Just like those sheep. But over there, that he saw it and he took one of the people out. And that's almost like the Buddha taking out one of the arahats. So it breaks the cycle. There's something else which you may be able to see. And so a lot of time the insight which we get, we find that when we actually keep precepts, we live a simple life, there's so many things we can't do, which means there's so many things we don't want to do. Our wanting is disappearing. We always believe that the more we can want, the more fun we can have. And that is the simile, which, you know, is a favorite one. And you've heard this before, but I keep on repeating these similes, because every time they actually just go deeper inside of you. And that's the descriptions of what Nirvana is, with the five children playing the wishing game. I love these stories simply because they actually take the Dhamma deeper, and you could use the framework of this simile so many times over to get deeper understandings of the nature of our world. Starting off with a simple story, five children playing a wishing game. The one who comes up with the best wish will win the wishing game. First kid said if he had a wish, he'd wish for a computer game. Second kid, I'll go through it quickly. Second kid, if he wanted a wish, he wished for a computer game shop so he can get any computer game whenever he wanted. The third, which is obviously a better wish, the third kid said, if I had a wish, because it's always when you have these stories, never be the first one who answers. The last one who answers is the best, which reminds me of this other story of this... of these... these are three... these three religious leaders. They went to these interfaith conferences, and what was it? It was the rabbi, the priest, and the monk. And the rabbi and the priest and the monk, they were just thinking, we can talk together, we can discuss things, but we need to actually to bond first of all. To actually create some personal relationships and trust amongst one another, first of all. Then we can maybe sort of open up and discuss, that where we agree and where we differ, in our religious theology, so that we can really just, we can really understand each other. So, they needed some games or tasks or something, and eventually they decided just easy enough to actually get out a pack of playing cards and play a game of poker. But, one thing led to another, and they started using money It wasn't real gambling, it was just to make it a bit more interesting. And then the police found them, arrested them, and they went into went to court because the gambling was not allowed in that place. And so the judge had these three religious leaders. You know, there was the priest, the rabbi, and the monk, Buddhist monk. And said to them, he said, look, you're all sort of leaders of your communities, you all got very good moral standing, but you are caught gambling. At least that's the charge. So you, first of all, you, the Catholic priest, were you gambling? Come on, just let me know. And really fast, faster than I could catch, he put his hand, you know, he prayed and said, please Jesus, forgive me. And then he said, no. And it wasn't. It was really fast, and even the judge didn't see him. Said, okay, off you go. Then the rabbi. And I don't know if any of you, but I remember doing this at school sometimes, somehow or other, if you crossed your fingers behind your back, it didn't count. So the rabbi crossed his fingers behind the back and said, no, I wasn't gambling. So off you go. And then the Buddhist monk. And a Buddhist monk, you know, we can't pray to somebody and you can't cross fingers behind your back. So he had to be honest. So they asked the Buddhist monk, where are you gambling? And he looked to the judge straight in the eyes, his hands were in front, he didn't pray. And he said, with whom, your honour? So that's why it always helps to be the last. Anyway, so going back to the third kid. And so, well, if I had a wish, I'd wish for $1 billion US. And just, you know, a whole heap of money, however. And with $1 billion US, I will buy my own computer game shop. Now, if any of you have got kids, know the problem with playing computer games is you've got your homework to do. So he said, the next thing I'll do is I'll buy my own school. You have private schools. So if I own a school and I employ the principal and all the teachers, they better not let my mum and dad know that I'm not passing the exams. They have to give me top grades. Otherwise, I'll sack them. So that way, I can spend all my day in school, you know, but playing computer games all day. And and they still give me top marks. And then the trouble is that, you know, when you graduate from school and you have to go to sort of university, you know, what are you going to do then? Buy my own university. That's what Mr. Trump did. Trump University. So when I own my own university, I give myself honours degrees and goodness knows what else. And then afterwards, that, you know, that I can spend all my time just playing computer games. And I can never get in any trouble with my parents because I pass all my exams. Sort of. Anyway, that was his idea. Very good. The fourth kid. And this is where it gets interesting. How can you do better than $1 billion? And never say 2 billion or 10 billion. It's just more money than you can ever spend. So, what's the next wish? And the next wish was, I wish I had 3 wishes. That's a wish. So my first wish, I would have the computer game shop. The second wish, I'd have $1 billion US. And my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Now that's getting very smart. Having an infinity of wishes granted to you. Can you get better than that? That's like being God. Having total power, whatever you want, and it's there for you. So the last child was such an amazing person. He said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed a wish ever again. And of course, that's the enlightened one. So content you don't need wishes. You're happy, you're content. Now that is a very profound little anecdote because it describes where people think they should find happiness in this world. First of all, in riches. second in power. Rich is having $1 billion so you can get whatever you want, buy whatever you want. Power. So, you can have any wish is granted to you. And lastly, much better than all of that, contentment, peace. You don't need any more wishes. Ever again. Peace. Enlightenment. Freedom from craving. Freedom from want. Peace at last. Now you can understand why many people prefer to be the fish in the tank. Peace. Never needing any wish. Food coming. A nice place to live. Warm. Everything provided. Just like Jhana Grove. This is like fish tank. And what do the fish do all day? Mindfully swimming from the left to the right. Turning around and mindfully swimming back again. And you think that must be boring, but you can see them just happily. Those fish are onto something. They're not bored. They're just meditating. Because sometimes people in the world don't understand a lot of time what we're up to. Just like when you do your walking meditation. Hopefully you've done that. I don't know if I've explained it well enough, but you start at one place and one end of the walking path, and then you lift your foot. Not looking at it, just lifting it. But it's very hard for you to lift your foot now, but keep looking at me. And then just lift your right hand. How do you know that? You can feel it's being lifted. Move it forward. Then put it down. When you do a walking meditation, you do that with your feet instead of just the hand. You're really aware of just how this thing actually moves. And please, if you can, take your socks off, unless you've got smelly feet. And when you do the walking meditation, you actually feel the skin against, you know, whatever you're walking on. It's just really sort of, it makes it a fuller experience. And you walk, you know, at your own pace from the beginning, from the start to the end, you turn around, you walk back again, backwards and forwards, just being aware, mindful of the feelings in the feet. It's so simple. You're not sort of looking to the left or the right. You know, you're not, you know, listening to sort of a talk. Because the trouble is that sometimes people do that. And if it's my talks, every now and again you hear this groan. And this is supposed to be a path without groaning. But unfortunately some of my jokes are just... You can't excuse a groan every now and again. But anyhow... So there you are just, and you become enclosed in your own little fish tank as you're just moving backwards and forwards. And it's a great experience. The first year when I ordained in this was in Wat Saket. This is the middle of Bangkok. It was really noisy and it took me a while before I could find my way to see Ajahn Chah. But nevertheless, I had an hour every morning after we did a little bit of chanting in the hall, every morning before lunch. And I would meditate. I knew it was 1 hour because it's a crazy thing, but it was a fashion. Even in Wat Phapong, they had grandfather clocks. So every quarter of an hour, ding, ding, dong, ding, and on the hour, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding. And I came here for some peace and quiet. The grandfather. I don't know why they had them there. But anyway, they were there. But anyway, what the monks did, we found the key and we took the, opened up the cabinet and took the weights out so it wouldn't work anymore. We hid them for a bit of peace and quiet. You know, we had all these schemes. Sometimes when you're a young monk, you've got a restless mind. You know, how you can work the system. And so what I remember seeing, Okay, I'm going to have to take you out for a few minutes. Ajahn Chah was always in charge of the gong. So, you know, at the end of the talk or the end of the meditation, you know, he would do the gong. And sometimes you wondered, you know, was Ajahn Chah sitting in a jhana, which means he'd be there for 3 or 4 hours and I need to go to the toilet. Well, actually, not much of the toilet, and he was not fed up, wanting to go to sleep. So, you know what I thought of doing? You're thinking, how can I can't get up there, sneak up and just ring the gong. So I thought this amazing trick. You know the what's it called, the catapult thing? I thought, I can train. I won't do it straight away because, you know, I'll probably miss him. What happens if I hit Ajahn Chah? That'd be really bad karma. But you know, you can just train in the forest until you're really accurate, and then sort of, you know, whenever you wanted, you know, because you're tired, but you just want to finish, you just bing, bing, and before Ajahn Chah knew it, bang, 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 and you were out. But I never had the nerve to do that because Ajahn Chah would probably know what you're up to with his psychic powers. But anyhow, just you didn't really do that. But when you actually got into your own little bubble, when you were doing your walking meditation, it became so peaceful. Even when there was the gongs, you know, from the grandfather clock. So the grandfather clock was actually useful because it rang every quarter of an hour. It took me half an hour to get from one end to the other. It was probably about the size of this hall here, about that size. Walking meditation, not forcing it, not trying to be slow, but just there was so much going on. Just, you know, to lift a foot and to raise it. It just went back a little bit before it went forward. And after a while, it's so fascinating, so much stuff happening, it was so peaceful. You got into this little cocoon world, which was delightful. And I know it was delightful. It was a form of like samadhi, one-pointedness, very still. Because on that occasion, that I'd forgotten that morning there was a ceremony which I was supposed to attend. And I hadn't turned up, and so, you know, the preceptor, Somdekyo, sent a monk to go and get me. And so there I was, just doing my walking meditations. I didn't say lifting, lifting, it was just too much going on to disturb it by speech. I felt the foot moving up and going forward. This is really rushing it, going forward. And then, from a long distance, you heard a sound. It wasn't the grandfather clock for a change. It was Rama Wamsa. It was, you know, like, you know, you expect like a ghost or something. Rama Wamsa. And of course, when you're very peaceful, you know, you contemplate it. Wonder what that is. Is it like a nimitta? Is it, you know, so sometimes people have sound nimittas. And, you know, what does that mean? Is it some deva? And then, And I realized it wasn't a long distance away. It was about that far from my ear. And a monk was shouting in my ear. They're literally shouting because trying to get my attention when I was really getting into the walking meditation. Unfortunately, the monks knew, you know, what happens when you do deep meditation and even walking meditation. You know, you're in this lovely little bubble having a wonderful time. But then I realized, oh yeah, I've got to come out. And you know how hard it is to come out from deep meditation, even walking meditation. For those of you who've been there, you just don't want to move, you can't move. If you do move, you're just going to come out very, very slowly. And that's what I had to do. I had to move my head. You know, moving your head, Craig, uses so many muscles. It's fascinating just to move your head a little bit to the right. after watching all these incredible different muscles move so that my head could go round. And it did actually literally take me 1 or 2 minutes before I faced this monk. And then, of course, I said, "What?" It took me a long time for actually to get going again. So, but that was what it's like doing walking meditation. You can get very peaceful and very happy and very joyful in your own little world because you don't want anything. You're just walking. And you get so content and so peaceful. And you realize in little things like this how wonderful it is to want nothing in the whole world. Just being observing, just one step moving. What some people think is boring is really interesting and exciting. That's why I would quite prefer just doing a bit of walking meditation, lifting my foot, than going in the death drop, or bungee jumping, or going at 2,000 kilometers an hour or something through outer space, you know, because, you know, it's supposed to be thrilling. Don't need to see Niagara Falls. You just watch your foot fall gently onto the carpet. Wow. Simple stuff is beautiful. So this is actually where we learn just how restraint, simplicity, being slow, not rushing after enlightenment, but learning how to stop and be here, is just part of the part of meditation. But of course, it's great to have it comfortable, like in the rooms. If you do want to walk, fine. But there was that time, it wasn't, you know, my type of meditation retreat, it was a Vipassana retreat, which is fine. But when they do the walking meditation, they all do it together. So you sit at a certain time, then you get up and walk. So they're all walking outside, I think in the car park or somewhere, doing it for their walking meditation. And that was when, just a few minutes afterwards, this family and kid, they came to see me at Bodhinyana at lunchtime, or just after lunch. Because you do see that, you know, every now and again we have some visitors just coming in. And, you know, you can always tell them to, if they're making too much noise, we can give them the one finger sign. You know the one finger sign, don't you? But not that one finger sign, the polite one. Because no matter what country they come from, that is an internationally accepted sign for. So you can always tell them to be quiet, but every now and again it's nice to be able to let them see, you know, where their donations go to and see actually people meditating, and it inspires them, and who knows that maybe next time they might join up and come for a meditation retreat. But in this particular case, they came with a kid and the kid freaked out. And they took him to see me straight away. And he said, "Ajabab, Ajabab, Ajabab, you've got to go to your retreat center now." "What's the problem? What's the problem?" "It's been taken over by zombies." Because apparently there's been so many films of zombies. And zombies is, you know, like a sort of a, I don't know, everyone's zombie-ing around. But anyway, you can imagine how a kid would interpret people doing walking meditation. Lifting, lifting, lifting. Moving, moving, moving. And he was convinced there were zombies that had taken over China Crow because they were walking really slowly. And so to this day, over in monastery, we call that type of meditation zombie walking meditation. Just a bit of fun. But the other time, was even more interesting, was when Ajahn Sumedho first went over to England and they went to Chithurst, and it was just a lot of work, getting that building up to scratch, you know, so there was like central heating because it was freezing in there. And I don't know why, but, you know, because I was trained in Thailand, I would just always get up at 3 o'clock. You know, I've let things slip a bit in my old age, and I get up at 4. But in those days, you'd always be up at 3. So I got up at 3, and what should I do at 3 o'clock? So I went into the shower, and then I was having a nice shower, and then there was somebody in the next cubicle, and they were singing in the shower. But it wasn't like a normal sort of song. It was like, ooh, ooh, ah, ooh, ooh, ah, ooh, ooh. And I thought, I've been away from UK for such a long time. It may be some sort of rap or reggae, I don't know. But then, when the monk came out, some of you know his name, it was Ajahn Sucitto. He was just really austere. And I said, are you all right? Because he was singing there. He wasn't singing, he was moaning because he had to have a cold shower. That was his having a cold shower every morning. And if you have a cold shower, oh, ah, ooh, 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 ah, ooh. I thought he was singing some really strange type of music. He doesn't mind me saying things like that. That's good fun. So anyway, so that means that... how to get onto that one? Oh yeah, just the walking meditation. Yeah. So you do it naturally, and so, but be careful because, oh that's right, in this one over in England, she was the head psychiatrist at a medical institution for the mentally ill. And everybody knew, you know, in the village, you know, English villages. English people, I don't think they've changed over the years. Everybody knows everybody, and they're pretty bored in there, so looking through the windows and getting whatever gossip and just makes their life interesting. I don't know why. But anyway, so she had a big house, and so they were using it for a weekend retreat. When it came to the walking meditation, again, they were wearing white, you know, to like an under, fresh out of the institution. That's what they thought. These people in white, you know, the 8 precepts, and they're just walking really slowly in the garden of this big house in the village. And of course, one of the ladies, wow, you know, this psychiatrist, the doctor, she's brought her patients back for the weekend. And she called the police. And the police squad cars came with the seven ambulances to take them back. Not to the monastery, but to the... And it took a lot of explaining, you know, with the police and whatever, to actually say, no, these are actually meditators. This was about 30, 40 years ago, and people didn't know what meditation was. But anyway, they got away with it, but they allowed them to stay. But it was a close thing. So anyway, but when you are, it looks strange to other people. It's weird. But don't worry what other people think of you, because you know it feels good. And a lot of times, if you really do want people to think well of you, you know, to admire you, to praise you, you don't get that by just pandering to what people want you to do. You get that by just knowing what is necessary to do and how it's done and being peaceful and feeling calm. Or was it one of those monks that he, you know, when he became a monk, it's a 50-50 chance you know who this monk is, because when he ordained, his parents did not want him to ordain. But, you know, he was old enough, so allowed him to ordain as a monk. But then when his father had a heart attack and died, he went over to Europe to help out. And of course, his mother and his family, yes, you can come, but leave your robes in Australia. You come in a suit. If you haven't got one, you can bring your robes to the airport and we'll have a suit for you to change into. And he's a devout monk. He just wanted to be a monk. So he showed me the, showed me the letter from his parents. And I told them, so right back, it's either these robes or naked. So which one would you be most embarrassed with? So he wore his robes, and I think his father died. And then, when he came back, he stayed there for a while. When he came back, his family wrote, "We apologize, Ajahn Brahm. We didn't understand what it is to be a Buddhist monk. And now, our brother, I think it was the elder brother who wrote this letter, he was such an incredible support for our family. And when everyone else didn't know what to do, you know, he did. I don't know what you've been teaching him in Buddhism over in Perth, but carry on. He has the whole family's support from now on." A wonderful letter to see that he decided not to follow what his family wanted him to do, but what he felt he needed to do. And he walked that path long enough that it was a huge support for his family in times of difficulty and trouble. And now, of course, he's got their 100,000,000% support. And they found out what's going on. And so this is when you actually follow what you know is right, what you feel is the correct thing to do. It may be in a fishbowl. It may be in a tank. It may be doing things which other people in the world think, what the heck are you doing that for? You stand your ground. You know it's the right thing to do. And it always gives you lots of peace, especially like restraint. It's why they call it, this is the path without groaning. And this is the first thing when you do keep those precepts. Now your goodness, as you know them. You know, you can't say, what are the precepts? You know, most of those precepts you know inside. That's why when you ask that question about what's allowable in the afternoon, you can know that just by what feels right. What you need to be peaceful, happy, not indulging, just to enhance your meditation. That's more important than the precepts, how you feel about it. And you trust yourself, you're not indulging. You don't need to have these things. You don't need to have them, then don't. So that means that, you know, you have this wonderful sense of integrity. And it's called the blameless. Oh, is that the right? The blameless. Anuvajjasukha. Yeah, Anuvajjasukha. And Anuvajjasukha, the blameless happiness. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, it's actually a payoff for actually being restrained. I thought being restrained would be really boring. I can't do this and I can't do that. I really want to do it, but I can't do it. And maybe I could sneak in doing it. Now I feel bad about it then. And so I thought, just being keeping all these rules. I should be out there just doing stuff and just enjoying it while I can and ticking off all the things on my bucket list before it gets too long and what I have to see and what I have to enjoy and where I have to go, what I have to experience. Life is to be experienced. Get out and have a life, Ajahn Brahm. No, thank you. Instead, you get the Anuvajjasukha, the blameless happiness. It's integrity. It's goodness. It's a form of happiness and energy. And then, just a restraint. You're not disturbed by stuff. You're living a simple life. You're not going out there into the world just trying to excite your senses. The first opportunity, you go in your room and calm down your senses. And that's the Abhisekha Sukha. Sekhara Sutta. I think I just know the Pali word for it. There's even a higher form of happiness from restraint. And I thought, wow, this is weird. I always thought that to get happiness, you've got to explore and live an exciting life. Be the Bear Grylls of... No, you don't want to go out. Exciting life and going into dangerous places. What do you want to do that for? Much better to restrain and be peaceful. The happiness is higher, deeper, more profound. And that's your only just starting. These are insights you get. Why is it you come on this retreat for 9 days? And sometimes, for some of you, it's the only holiday you get. And that's why people keep saying, What? Where did you go over the Easter weekend and the Anzac Day? Where did you go on your holidays this year? Ah, I went to this retreat center where we can't eat in the evening, where there's no TVs, we can't go anywhere or do anything, we can't even speak. And they think you're absolutely mad and crazy. And more than that, you had to pay for this. I mean, not much, it's a pretty cut price. I said, what? You guys just, girls, you know, you should get a life. But then, you go back, and you thought, wow, he's so happy, he's so peaceful, so relaxed, so, and it's actually just going back to say where you've been for the last week is actually quite radical. You had an opportunity to go and explore, to go down Margaret River, get some chocolate, go surfing, go watch the whales, go and whatever. But you decided just to watch your mind, to find peace, instead of eating or tasting wine or eating chocolate. Actually, you did do the chocolate, but that's just a bit different. But you find that this is radical. And that's one of the nice things about Buddhism, about meditation. You're not following other people like sheep. You're doing something strange, weird, but it's actually, it's a path of peace and happiness. And even wisdom. You're actually understanding about how you work, how your health is, and how your body works, and how your mind interacts with the body. Every now and again, people just send me these emails. And they send me these emails, Ajahn Brahm, you know, just Harvard has just found out that what you've been saying for years is true. You know, about sort of worrying and about the future. And if you worry about it, you make these things happen. About the nature of the will. And that you actually successful people, they don't use the will. They use like the wisdom power and kindness. Somebody sent me that a couple of days ago. And, of course, you see these things, you understand these things, you get into them. And after a while, you know, when other people find out these things in Harvard and Princeton and goodness knows where else, and of course they're true. The nature of your body. How does your body work? It's weird, but you ask the other monks, and all those monks of Bodhinyana, I'm the oldest. Oh, no, well, the oldest in years as monks. So the fattest. That's just gravitas. But the healthiest. Very rarely do I get sick. And if I do get sick, it doesn't matter. I can still give talks even though you're coughing. Why? Why is that the case? Because you understand the nature of your mind. And how it interacts with the body. Why is it even the Buddha said, if he wanted to, he could have carried on for the whole eon? What do you mean by that? If the mind is so powerful, you can understand what happens in the body, you can deal with it, if it wants to. So, these are some of the stuff which you understand just how your mind works and how powerful it is. So you don't need to follow what other people do. If you do, you're just going to be one of those sheep. What do they say in the suttas? The people, for the most part, they wander up and down on this side of the shore. Very few of those who cross to the other side. Why? And it's because sometimes we don't have that courage to actually just to see something different, to look at it in a different way. I told monks this, and it's pretty accurate. You know, just across to the other side, to actually too get a jhana, get a stage of enlightenment. It's just like you can imagine a stream. You're going up this way, down that way, trying to find a bridge, trying to find a boat. All you need to do is just to turn 90 degrees and just step over. It's not that wide. But just to finding the direction The direction is not the usual one would expect. The direction is not wanting to achieve something, trying to get somewhere, trying to do something, going this way, reversing, going that way, reversing. It's going a different way altogether. The way of letting go. The way of letting go of wanting. Sitting here, just being here, being content and easily satisfied. Ah, this is good enough for me. Just walking, meditation in a little room. Lifting my foot and having no other care in the whole world. Just engrossed, delighted in the muscle movement of one little toe moving up from the floor. Sitting meditation, not trying to get jhanas, not aiming for enlightenment, but just being with this one part of this one little in-breath. Happy to be here, delighted in just this one moment of peaceful existence. I don't want anything in the whole world. This is enough. You vanish, you disappear. As Ajahn Chah said, and this is just summing up the whole talk, it was the simile of the mango orchard. And I don't know why, but I never saw it in any other book written about the time of Ajahn Chah, but I remember it clearly. One of the reasons I remember it, because I thought it was one of the most stupid similes I'd ever heard. I didn't understand it at all. But because it came from Ajahn Chah, because it stood out by its incomprehensibility, I think that was probably why I remembered it. And so I did put it in the last book, which I wrote somewhere anyway. But the reason I put it in there, because no one else had mentioned the great Ajahn Chah, who said that his monastery was like the mango orchard. And every tree was planted by the Buddha. And they were still alive. And they're full of mangoes, really ripe, delicious mangoes. It's out of the world delicious mangoes. But you can't climb the tree to get the mango. You can't shake the tree to get the mango. You can't get a ladder, or these days a cherry picker, to get the mango. You can't, how else we get the mango? Just throw things up at the mango to try and get them down, the mango tree. You can't. There's only one way that you can ever successfully get a mango from the trees planted by the Buddha. And that is to sit perfectly still underneath the mango tree. Hold out your hand and a mango will fall. Sadhu, 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 Ajahn Chah. Totally ridiculous, I thought. Because everything I'd ever done in my life, I'd struggled for. Yeah, I could take that tree and start. I was really strong in those days. I could shake it, keep on shaking it until something fell. Or climb up. I don't know, or get sort of a cherry picker or something with my... Instead of ringing the bell, get a mango. That would not work. What did he mean? Sit perfectly still, hold out your hand, and a mango will fall. Stillness? Not wanting. Not wanting the mango. Perfectly still, not moving. Not planning. Not figuring out how this could be done. Not getting out your mobile phone and going on Wikipedia, oh no, on Google. Mango orchard, Ajahn Chah, how to get. Or whatever, I don't know, I'm not good at this thing. You just sit totally still. And of course, putting out your hand, opening up your heart. Compassion, kindness, always there, somewhere along the line. Open your heart, your hand, then mango falls. That is how you get enlightened. Not wanting it. Stillness and kindness. Few who actually find that path and cross over. Most think of ways to try and get the mango. They start to build trellises so they can get up there. Or they get the chainsaw and chop the tree down so the tree falls and comes to where you are. And they think of all these incredible ways and means instead of the right way. Thank you. That is how you get mangoes. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I did the he's in the wrong order this time. Why not? Have a wonderful morning if you wish. You don't have to.